All right. This is an exciting topic today. Today I have Chris M. Evans, not to be confused with the 1800 other Chris Evans. There's one popular right now. He has an American shield and all of that good stuff. This guy, when you hear his voice, you can't mistake him. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Keith. Yeah, there is some guy. I don't know who he is. Never seen him before. Some guy purporting to be me. Interesting story. When I first tried to register a Twitter handle, Chris Evans, just Chris Evans as one name, was gone. It wasn't taken, but it was not available. And obviously, it was one of those names that they'd clearly reserved, thinking somebody would come along and say, "I want that."
The Chris Evans would show up.
Whichever one they decided.
Chris Evans, you showed up. It wasn't available.
Yeah, it's dependent on which Chris Evans they decided they thought was the most popular that they wanted to use. But there you go.
That is quite funny. Is Chris Evans the movie actor? The Chris Evans on
he is
on Twitter.
Yeah, yes.
I guess that proves your theory. So for those of you who know Chris M. Evans, you probably know him more as a storage expert, which is ironic, because Chris, I know you more as a mainframe expert. It seems like every time we get together, we were together last week for Cloud Field Day 13.
We absolutely
were. You know, our first conversation was around mainframes.
Yeah, so it's interesting, actually. So for the first 10 or so years of working, I was a mainframe systems programmer with a bit of a specialism in storage. So I did a lot of management of those sort of environments. But funny enough, I haven't done hands-on mainframe for probably 15 years. So maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing, but it's been a while since I've actually done the mainframe side. But I did end up in the sort of early 2000s going towards the storage side and doing a lot more work in that area. But really, originally, I was a sysadmin, the equivalent in the mainframe world.
And that's funny you say sysadmin. I don't want to get off too far of a tangent. There was not the concept of a sysadmin in the mainframe days. You were just a programmer. I mean,
well, no, you the systems programmer title was effectively a sysadmin. That's what you did. You programmed the system, you operated, installed it, and managed it. It wasn't writing code in the same sense as a developer would be nowadays. Gotcha. So yeah, so think systems programmer, think sysadmin.
All right. So with that, and with your most recent experience, you're at Cloud Field Day, and you were keeping up with the most complex Kubernetes and container conversations. I think a lot of what was old is new again. you know, the concept of containers and partitions and virtualization, all of that, of course, originated with the mainframe. So we're coming full circle of sorts.
Yeah. So let me just point something out, which is really quite funny. And just before we decided to do this recording, like 2 minutes before we actually logged in to the software to start recording, I posted about one of the presenters at that event, which is the one that was doing Kubernetes optimization, the StormForge solution. The interesting thing is, in my summary at the very end, I said, "What's old is new in IT." I literally used the expression you've just used because it's entirely true.
It is funny. I didn't do much. When I was at university, I would do some shared programming on mainframes, or mini computers, more likely. But not much of system administration. So, you know, I wasn't aware I was in a container or a virtualized environment. I just knew I had access to the system. I had a piece of a larger system and I could write my code and deploy my code. Funny enough, that code was Fortran and COBOL. I couldn't write a bit of it today if I tried, but that's what I was learning back in university days. IBM. And the reason why we're talking about this, IBM recently announced IBM Z for mainframe. IBM just recently announced IBM Z for the public cloud, not for production workloads for QA and test. And man, you have gotten into a discussion about running Linux on the mainframe, which is nothing new. Give us the, you know, kind of the rundown of how Linux works on a mainframe system.
Yeah, so IBM have had this for quite a long time, the ability to run Linux on the mainframe hardware, just as you would run ZOS, as it is called now, what in my day was called MVS, which went through a number of iterations, MVS XA, ESA. I think ESA was the last one that I used, and then I think after that it was renamed ZOS. Each of those different iterations actually aligned to a generation of the hardware, so the hardware gets iterated in the background. So if you've ever heard of System 360, System 370, they were the two architectures of the processor and associated equipment that were released in the 60s and 70s. There was no System 380 because IBM, I believe at the time, was in a bit of a conflict because they thought they might have a bit of a problem with the, antitrust situation in the US. So they didn't release a System 380, a story for another day, you know, another podcast, another discussion. Then they released System 390 in the 90s, and then it got renamed ZOS. But effectively, it's a continually upgraded hardware architecture which has an operating system which aligns with it, which is the operating system that developed in the 60s. Having said that, somebody at IBM, some bright spark at IBM before the Red Hat acquisition thought, yeah, great, look, do you know what? We could run Linux on this, because ultimately, Linux is a multitasking operating system, multi-threaded, multi-CPU. Why wouldn't we run something like that on the mainframe hardware? Perfectly possible.
And just so I understand it and the audience understands as well, so you have ZOS, the bare metal OS running on that.
Yeah.
It can create, it's actually pretty wonderful, depending on your, I don't know if there's a Z system that can't do hardware level partitioning. But you can do hardware level partitioning in ZOS, and then you can create basically virtual machines or independent virtual hardware similar to VMware, vSphere, or KVM today. Correct?
Yeah, you partition at the hardware level. So there's a feature called LPARS, logical partitions, which allows you to actually partition the hardware directly. So it's not software partitioning, it's hardware partitioning, but driven by software. And then within that, you can deploy an entire operating system. But typically, if you think of the mainframe environments, you deploy one massive operating system. So a system might only have three or four partitions, maybe one or two, depending on what you're doing, one for production, maybe one for development, maybe a couple, depending on what you wanted. And then within that, you would deploy separate applications. So you would run things like databases or front-end systems, which would have been a web server in those days, but was still available, called KIX, CICS, which is your transactional system, your OLTP system. Outside of that, you've got time-sharing users, which are logons. And then outside of that, you've got batch jobs, which run, you know, to process workload in the background.
So this is fascinating. So from a architecture perspective, is Linux considered a OS that's running bare metal on an LPAR, or is it a application?
Yeah, I believe it's running as a bare metal LPAR.
So if it's running as a bare metal LPAR, at this point, I think us x86 oriented folks can pick this up and start thinking about, all right, so I have an LPAR. It is a lot. For those of you who don't know, I did some work on HP UX and Itanium, and the HPE Superdome has very similar concepts. So I could take a LPAR, which for the Linux operating system, unlike in virtualization, looks like a physical machine to the OS. It's as if it's not aware of the other LPARs on the system. It is a physical machine. So in theory, and Chris can correct me, you could take Linux, install KVM, and then have an additional virtualization layer. You might think this is virtualization on top of virtualization, but I'd argue that it's not. This is hardware partitioning, hypervisor installed on top of that, and then virtual machines installed on top of that.
I'm going to confuse things ever so slightly, Keith, here. I'm going to add another layer of inception to this. So, yes, you're right. It's hardware partitioning, a bit like things like Superdome, a bit like you could do with some of the Solaris systems, where you could partition them up. And Amdahl, by the way, Amdahl made a whole IBM clone range of products that did the same sort of thing. What you can also do is you can run something like VM, or so a product that's now called ZVM, but used to just be called VMXA, yes. VMESA, which stands for virtual machine. And that would run on the entire machine. And then that would do the same logical hardware partitioning, but it would do it in software. So you would see separate images in that sense. So I've not thought about it in the sense that you've just said, but there's no reason to think that you can't virtualize on top of a hardware partition using something like whatever's available within the kernel of the Linux implementation that runs on the mainframe. So you've mentioned KVM, but it could be, I guess it could be whatever kernel-based virtualization code is available to you. You should be able to do it.
And HPUX has the exact same thing, HPX virtual machine, HPUX VM. Of course, I'm not going to take, there is no third-party virtual machine that runs on top of HPUX unless you install Linux on top, which is weird. And I haven't seen anyone do that. But this goes back to the conversation. We've not seen anyone do what we're talking about doing today. At least I don't personally know anyone. And one of our peers in the industry gave you some pushback on this. The big thing that Enrico Signoretti of GigaOM, his pushback was the libraries. You know, you have to have a company of size to create a custom library for this hardware architecture. And then your response?
Well, I think there's two sides to this. First of all, I would say, think a bit more about the hardware outside of just the processor architecture. So the one thing that you need to bear in mind with, say, the whole Z platform system is that there's additional pieces to it. So there's a slightly different memory architecture. You're not running NUMA. You're running a more symmetric multiprocessed memory architecture. But also you've got a storage subsystem and a network subsystem, which are separate from the processor. And much more powerful than, say, you know, could be on another platform. That was one of the big benefits of the mainframe many decades ago, that those things were effectively offloaded and would act independently. Now, I would suggest that if somebody like IBM is going to come to the market and try and deploy Linux on a mainframe, and somebody's going to be spending many millions buying that hardware to run that operating system, they're going to do it if they are confident that there are the libraries and there is the code to allow them to run pretty much every application they want to. I'd be very surprised if they weren't recompiled or reoptimized for the mainframe environment. Now, I don't know that for definite. That's one of those things that needs to be challenged, I guess, and somebody to go off and double check that that's the case. But, you know, you wouldn't go and buy something that wasn't fully optimized if that was going to be something you were going to spend millions on.
Yeah, this is a conversation I'd love to have with somebody from IBM, because I remember as an IBM customer in the 90s, the late 90s, IBM pushing Linux on mainframe all the way through the early 2000s. I fell out of the space around 2010. Funny enough, I supported mainframes and data centers. Wow. That's a whole other
You should be an expert now, Keith, then.
Yeah, that, like literally in 2008 to 2010, I had a customer slash employer who did mainframe as a service, and I did the data center hosting. I was responsible for the data center for that. So, mm-hmm. You know, I had to do power. I learned way more about power and cooling of mainframes, and unfortunately, mainframe networking than I wanted to ever know. So I have some context of getting pushed the idea of running common workloads like Linux. IBM has pretty solid support for it. They've thought about it. They've worked on it for a long time. There's customers doing it. And the reason why I brought this up, I don't think you were at this Cloud Field Day, Chris. There's a company. There's a couple of companies. There's Glue, who makes a kind of app for stitching together the new and the old. And then there's also everyone's friends at HashiCorp, who talk about this as kind of the reality of the world, that there are going to be applications that reach all the way back to the mainframe that have to interact with modern APIs with cloud-native applications. So the point of this podcast was kind of to stretch the imagination. What happens when you penetrate that third wall and say that, well, it's a Linux instance, and it has to run outside of the system where the data is at. When we know data gravity is real, what happens when I take Linux and run it close to where the data and the data and the heavy workloads are at? What has been your experience over the years of kind of integrating x86? Obviously, you're a storage expert and you're a mainframe expert. Not all storage, unlike back in the day, not all storage lives in the mainframe anymore or directly attached to the mainframe. Where are some of the common gotchas or considerations for connecting new to old?
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it? Because if you look at the raw sort of basic level of storage connectivity, you're looking at a very different set of profiles. So you're looking at FICON connectivity, which is the mainframe connectivity, compared to fiber channel, which is obviously the open systems implementation of the set of protocols for moving data across a network. Originally, I mean, I'm talking decades ago, so, you know, this is a long time ago, mainframes used a totally different architecture on disks. They used to use something called count key data, which was a different structure in the way that the blocks were organized, rather than FBA, which is the fixed block architecture that we see today. So from a physical layer, fundamentally, they were very different in the first place. So I think you wouldn't be actually sitting there thinking, I can make something that's going to allow me to access that data at that fundamental storage level. So you're going to have applications that are either reading or writing to their own storage associated with their platforms. So now we're pushing up a level. Now we're talking about APIs into databases and other components that allow me to share data. And you can imagine, I would expect things like object storage would become incredibly important at this point, because now we've got the ability to share similar data across different platforms and suck that data in and use it on a mainframe to do something, or push it out somewhere else. Or I use something like DBT or some of the other database technologies. Maybe I use my mainframe as my, you know, database engine for all this sort of stuff. Maybe I use it for my massive AI cluster. There's lots of options to do it, but I think you're looking at higher level protocols to move that data back and forth.
Yeah, I was looking back in 2016. I'm hat tip to my HPUX management days, where if you're not familiar, HPUX and Itanium is basically becoming end of life because of, market reasons.
Because nobody wants it.
Well, no one wants it, but a bunch of people built stuff around it. Namely, yeah. If probably the number one application running on it is SAP. And in 2016, if you had to make the decision to move off of HPUX onto something else, x86 kind of isn't going to work for you if you've built your operations around LPARs, Superdomes, etc. So it's either stay on HPUX, and if you thought mainframe is expensive, you know, buy HPUX blade from HPE, and you'll appreciate the cost structure of an IBM mainframe. That is a statement, because I looked into the alternative, which was to buy a Z system in 2016. Mm-hmm. It just made sense operationally. If I wanted a platform that was going to be continued to be supported past 2020, 2022, 2025, the IBM Z system just made sense. And this is, I've always had this curiosity about this API level integration. SAP, the big workload runs on that, and then a bunch of x86 around it, just like in my HPUX environment or my Solaris environment. So if you're coming out of environments where the architecture looks more like mainframe, it may not be, I have to say this begrudgingly, it may not be a bad deal to look at mainframe.
Yeah, well, let's think about it for a second. So let's look at the history of where we've gone over the last 50 years, and I'll try and not take, you know, 3 hours to make that discussion. But you started off with a situation where you had mainframe, which were large, monolithic, did everything. Everything was integrated into it. So, you know, everything from storage to networking, everything was one big machine, massive machine, including things like memory and CPU, all tightly integrated. We clearly had an issue with that in the 90s, and we had a lot of the mid-range stuff, people might have called it, but, you know, Sun, HPUX, even IBM with their own AIX platforms. And pretty quickly, those sort of faded off in favor of x86. And we moved to an architecture that was very much built on much smaller machines, but many more of them, and the ability to consolidate some workloads that would had been originally deployed on x86 prior to virtualization. The x86 has gone through a massive transformation, added the virtualization extensions and various other extensions in, and has done brilliantly well. But now we've got to a situation where now we're almost at a position where we want to build the big monolithic things again, because we're deploying applications in things like Kubernetes clusters, where the ability to do many, many massive parallel applications in one go, pointing to big data sets and to connect things like GPUs, becomes really interesting and really important. So I think the ebb and flow of the way that we deploy applications is causing us to push back to sort of newer architectures that are more like that monolithic mainframe environment.
Yeah, it's funny you said that. I literally just did a video last night that's sponsored. It'll come out probably in a month or so, that talks about that HPE-like vision of the machine a few years ago, yeah. Which is we're learning that vertically scaling up is still extremely desirable for supporting modern applications. The ability to just scale beyond the limits of a existing x86 box. Today, developers have to do cartwheels to get an application, especially an OLTP type app, to work across multiple systems. The architecture, the transaction nature, the nature of those transactions benefit from a system that can scale vertically. And now we're moving into this idea that if I can have a VM that goes across several x86 physical boxes, it is much easier to develop against than creating a distributed system like that. So we're moving the complexity down to the infrastructure and making it as simple as possible for the application developer, kind of like always.
Yeah, I mean, why did we end up with that, though? Because we ended up with a situation where our x86 boxes have become super reliable, which is fantastic. You know, they're much more reliable than they ever were, but they've reached limits of scalability. So the architecture within x86, for example, in something as simple as NUMA, doesn't really permit you to have more than two is okay, four's okay-ish, but go past four cores, four sockets, then you've got an issue with memory management, because you've got memory that could be connected to the wrong processor at any one particular time, and now you're moving data across an additional hop, which is going to reduce your I/O performance. From memory, that is, not from external performance. So what's the solution? Well, we go back to the models we had before, where we have tightly coupled, and maybe we're going to see a lot of the PCIe technology come in with CXL, which will connect memory more tightly. And tied to that is this need to use other processors like GPUs and SmartNICs. And every time you want to use one of those, you're being told, oh, you'd have to put that in a box, take the box apart, put the thing in, close it back up. And now you've got a sprawl of other technology that's going across all of these different servers that you can't easily use wherever you want to use it. So what's the simple way to get around that? Put it all in one massive machine where everything's easily connectable to anything, And either that could be done logically with things like Fungible and those other technologies, or you could just build one massive machine. And that's what I think what HPE were trying to do with the machine.
Yeah, what's old is new again. And we'll leave it on that. We're at time. So, Chris, for those who want to follow you, they can follow you, obviously, on Twitter, Chris M. Evans, as we said. But
absolutely.
You also write a lot. What's the blog?
I do write a lot. I try to write twice a week, although work gets in the way a lot of that, especially last week when we were away. That completely ruined my ability to do that. But it's very simply architecting.it. And then if you want to look at the blog, you can follow a link there, or you could go to architecting.it/blog. And also, of course, there is Storage Unpacked, which is our storage podcast, which lots of people follow. So people may, know me from that one as well. But yeah, and any of those will find me.
All right. And if you want to follow us, you can follow us on the web. TheCTOAdvisor.com is the website. And me on Twitter, I made it easy. CTO Advisor, spelt the proper way, O-R, instead of E-R. Chris, I thought you'd appreciate that.
Yes. And we won't get into that discussion. That again, would be another whole day's worth of conversation.
All right. Talk to you guys next CTO Advisor podcast.